Welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 529 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the series on the Step 2 CK Free 120. This is the 2024 one, the one that's on the website right now. And this is going to be part 10. We've done 70 questions so far in the series. So we're going to go ahead and pick up from where we stopped. So let's get right into it. So question 71, a 22-year-old man comes to the office for a health maintenance examination. He feels well and has not noticed any health issues. He's in the U.S. Army. 2 months ago, he returned from a 10-month deployment to Southwest Asia, during which he started smoking one pack of cigarettes daily. The patient says he is happy to be home and has been celebrating with his friends and family. He has been consuming an average of 6 beers daily since returning to the United States. He has no history of major medical illness. He does not use any medications or other substances. His mother has type 2 diabetes mellitus. The patient is 180 centimeters, that's 5 foot 11 inches tall, and weighs 72 kilograms, that's 160 pounds. His BMI is 22 kilograms per meter squared. His first blood pressure reading is 156 over 95 millimeters of mercury. Repeat reading is 160 over 92 millimeters of mercury. He says he remembers his blood pressure being normal when he had it checked in the past. Physical examination discloses no other abnormalities. Which of the following is the most likely cause of this patient's increased blood pressure? Option A says cigarette smoking. Option B says essential hypertension. Option C says excessive alcohol use. Option D says pheochromocytoma. Option E says renal artery stenosis. So what factor that's present in the Q-stim tells you that this tells you why this person's blood pressure may be elevated? Well, option E says cigarette smoking. Well, here's the thing. This person was also smoking when he was out of the country, and it doesn't seem like he had high blood pressure when he was out of the country. So I think I'd rule out option A. Option B says essential hypertension. Essential hypertension is usually going to be, usually probably the most likely cause of hypertension in most people. But that's typically going to be in the person that is unhealthy, you know. Obesity, which this person is not obese. Obesity, metabolic syndrome kind of deal. And again, this person is 22. It's unlikely that's going to be essential hypertension. So we're going to get rid of that. Option C says excessive alcohol use. Well, since he came back, he's been drinking 6 beers daily. That's a lot of alcohol. That's going to jack up your blood pressures. That's going to, alcoholism can raise a person's blood pressure. So I'll probably go with option C. Option D says pheochromocytoma. Pheochromocytoma, you're going to see episodic headache and hypertension. Remember, it has this association with MEN2A and 2B especially. We don't see that here, so that's off. Renal artery stenosis is usually going to be in an older person, although it can be in younger people. But those people have like flank buries and stuff. We don't see that here, so I'm not going to go with that. I think I like option C a lot here. So this person has to kind of, I know he's happy to be home, but he should probably kind of calm down on the drinking. His blood pressure probably normalizes with that. Remember, if they give you a question about a woman that's reproductive age and has high blood pressure, what's the risk factor for that? That's OCP use, right? That's kind of high to know for exams. Okay, so question 72, a 32-year-old man comes to the office because of a 3-month history of a painless rash over his arms. Okay, during the past month, he also has had a 7-pound, that's a 3.2 kilogram weight loss, despite no change in appetite. He has no history of serious illness and takes no medications. He's 175 centimeters, that's 5 foot 9 inches tall, and weighs 72 kilograms, that's 158 pounds. BMI is 23 kilograms per meter squared. Pulse is 98 per minute. All the vital signs are within normal limits. Lungs are clear to auscultation. Cardiac examination shows no abnormalities. A photograph of the left upper extremity is shown. Similar findings are noted over the right upper extremity. So it's a diffuse process. Which of the following is the most likely cause of this patient's dermatologic findings? So option A says actinic keratosis. Option B says dermatitis herpetiformis. Option C says Kaposi sarcoma. Option D says lichen planus. Option E says seborrheic dermatitis. So this is actually a pretty good question, because there's not many clues that are supplied in the Q-STEM, but they supply an image. So this is one of those questions where I imagine a lot of people panic with the image. Again, I think I've kind of explained this to you many times, but the image is not typically absolutely necessary to you answering the question correctly. But obviously, for a question like this, if you knew what the image was asking, then you're solid. You can get this one at the tip of a hat. But again, just use the process of elimination, right? Like, for example, option A. Okay, let's look at what's bad in this question. This person has had this painless rash, has lost weight. It's kind of worrisome, right? Lost weight. And we see that this process is diffuse. So, and, you know, it's kind of a youngish guy. So we look at option A, saying actinic keratosis. This is usually going to be in a person that has been out in the sun for a long period of time, like a gardener, landscaper, stuff like that, right? And they're going to have it like a rash, like a sandpaper-like rash. It's going to have like a rough texture. We don't see that here, so that's off. I'm not going to go with A. Option B says dermatitis or piriformis. We tend to find that in celiac disease. So they will give you a question stem that talks about malabsorption, iron deficiency, anemia, you know, vitamin D deficiency, stuff like that. We don't see that here, so we're going to get rid of that. Kaposi sarcoma usually shows up with skin findings. It's a kind of malignancy. It's associated with a HHV-8. Or sometimes we call that KSHV, Kaposi sarcoma associated with herpes virus. And, you know, it kind of spreads sometimes. So let's keep that for now. Option D says lichen planus. Lichen planus, remember the P's, right? It's going to be polygonal. It's going to be purple. It's going to be like a papule or a plaque. And we usually find it around like the wrists, around the ankles, stuff like that. This does not look like that at all. So we're gonna get rid of that. And then option E says seborrheic dermatitis. Usually we're gonna see that in a Parkinson's patient or HIV patient. It's gonna involve like areas of hair growth, right? So like around the cheeks, basically where there's hair. That's not what's going on here. So I'm not gonna go with that. And we see this person losing weight and stuff, right? So that's kind of worrisome for like a malignant process. So I would go with Kaposi sarcoma for this one. Honestly, this one is actually quite a, it's kind of a question with very few clues. But again, I feel like you can at least get very close to the right answer. At least get it down to one or two answers. If you just kind of got rid of the answers that make no sense, right? So that don't really fit the bill. So I think for this one, I'll go Kaposi sarcoma, losing weight. This skin lesion is a diffuse process, painless rash. People that have Kaposi sarcoma, the lesions tend to be purple. This thing certainly looks purple to me. And it tends to, again, kind of be diffuse, right? So I think I like this one for Kaposi sarcoma. Remember, for Kaposi sarcoma, you're either going to, like, if they have HIV, treat the HIV. Usually that will take care of the Kaposi sarcoma. We can inject steroids into the lesion. You can inject chemo into the lesion. There's many different things you can do for Kaposi sarcoma. All right, let's go to question 73. A 42-year-old nolligravid woman comes to the office because of a 6-month history of hot flashes and intermittent palpitations. Her last menstrual period was 6 months ago. Menses previously occurred at regular 29-day intervals, but gradually had occurred less frequently during the past 2 years. She underwent ovarian cystectomy 13 years ago for a small benign teratoma. She used an oral contraceptive for 12 years until tubal ligation 6 years ago. Her mother and sister had menopause at the ages of 47 and 49 years respectively. The patient has smoked one pack of cigarettes daily for 26 years. That's not wise. She is sexually active and monogamous with one male partner. She's 170 centimeters, that's 5'7" tall, and weighs 86 kilograms, that's 191 pounds. BMI is 30 kilograms per meter squared. Pulse is 82 per minute, and blood pressure is 130 over 85 millimeters of mercury. Physical examination, including pelvic examination, discloses no abnormalities. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in diagnosis? So option A says measurement of serum follicle-stimulating hormone concentration. Option B says measurement of serum luteinizing hormone concentration. Option C says Measurement of serum testosterone concentration. Option D says ECG. Option E says pelvic ultrasonography. So what do you think? What do you think? That's a pretty straightforward question. Someone's in her 40s. She's having menopause-like symptoms. We're like, man, you're 42. Although 42 is not too early. It's kind of early, but it's not super early. Remember, we say people have premature ovarian failure when they start having all these issues before age 40. But this person is past age 40. So not a big deal here. So what's the answer here that kind of relates to checking if a person is kind of hitting menopause, if their ovaries beginning to kind of shrivel up? It's just checking the FSH levels. It's going to be elevated, right? Because essentially these people's gonads are not working. The ovaries are not working, so they are not making estrogen. If you don't make estrogen, there's no negative feedback. So your gonadotropins like FSH, it's going to be elevated. So I'm going to go with option A here. I know option B kind of looks good as well, but usually if we're trying to determine these things, FSH is just a common thing they go after on exam. So I'm not going to be too hamstrung by option B. Option C, that's ridiculous. Usually option C, something you think about with like low libido. ENT just make no sense here. All right. Question 74. A colleague of a 47-year-old physician who is conducting patient evaluations during afternoon walk-in clinic hours notices that the physician appears groggy, has slurred speech, and smells of alcohol. Oh, that's not good. Earlier in the day, the physician had attended a celebratory lunch for the graduation of one of the clinic's employees from nursing school. The colleague has not witnessed similar findings in the physician in the past. The physician is scheduled to work at the clinic for the next 4 hours. A physician assistant is present at the clinic and typically aids the physician with evaluating patients. Which of the following is the most appropriate action for the colleague to take at this time? Option A says, allow the physician to finish his time at the clinic, but raise concern about the episode at the next physician staff meeting. Option B says, ask the office administrator to cancel the remainder of the clinic hours. Option C says, ask the physician assistant to examine the physician's patients and discharge them before the physician has a chance to examine them. Option D says, confront the physician and ask him to leave the clinic. Option E says, report the physician to the clinic administrator and conduct the remainder of the clinic hours without him. Option F says, report the physician to the state medical board. All right. So this is an impaired physician. There are certain rules and principles to follow when you're dealing with an impaired physician. Rule number one, the person has to be removed from patient care immediately. They can't keep caring for patients, right? You don't want them to kill somebody. This is a simple rule of thumb to follow. And then number two, they got to get reported. It's a hazardous practice, right? So they need to get reported. So basically, let's look at an answer that helps us accomplish objective one, that C, we're going to remove this person from patient care right now. And usually when you remove them from patient care, the person that does the removing is a very senior person in the organization, a very, very senior person in the organization. Every hospital has like a chief of medical staff or something like that, you know. So option A is wrong, right? Oh, keep going. And then we'll raise it at the next staff meeting. What if a person kills somebody from their care? That's ridiculous. That's off. Option B, ask the office administrator to cancel the remainder of the clinic hours. Seems like there's people that can do the job. And again, we're literally not removing the person from patient care. You need to pick the answer that removes the person from patient care. Removes the person, not the patient, right? The patient should get care, right? If you can. Option C says, ask the physician assistant to examine the physician's patients and discharge them before the physician has a chance to examine them. No, you're not removing this person from patient care. I don't like option C. Option D says, confront the physician and ask him to leave the clinic. Okay, that seems like a good one. Let's keep that for now. Option E says, report the physician to the clinic administrator and conduct the remainder of the clinic hours without him. Okay, so you are a physician, so obviously you can treat these patients. And report to the clinical administrator. Yes, that's probably a good thing to do. So the administrator is a person in charge, right? The person usually is well-versed in how to handle these problems. And then option F says, report to the state medical board. No, the state medical board is something you're going to do down the line. The person has got to be written up, but not right now, right? So between options D and E, you know, confronting the physician, asking to leave the clinic versus report to the clinic administrator and conduct the remaining hours without him, I like option E better, right? Confronting the physician, like how successful is that going to be? Right? Because it's just your suspicion. The thing is, many times when you suspect bad behavior on the part of a healthcare professional, sad to see this, but you gotta report them, right? You need to make some kind of documentation, some kind of record. But again, that person has to be removed from clinical care. I feel like option E is just much better, because in option D, you're confronting the person, but you're not lodging any complaints with the higher-ups in the clinic. You got to lodge a complaint. It's a patient safety event. Patient safety events always have to be reported. So option E makes the most sense. Again, if you want to be well-versed in dealing with these kinds of conundrums, I definitely have a class that can help you. I have a 5-hour social sciences class. It's going to be taking place on the 20th of this month. It's for step 1 to step 3. We have like 200 plus scenarios that we deal with revolving around the healthcare systems, social sciences, ethics, and whatnot. Many people have taken the classes, found it to be extremely helpful. And also, I will say that I also have a biostats class that's 4 hours long. It's on the 19th of this month. And a test-taking strategies class is 2.5 hours long. These classes are not lectures. They're all like scenarios, MBME-style questions to buttress these points. And they're all for step 1 to step 3. And then starting on the 22nd of this month, I have a 20-hour step 2, step 3 class. Again, pretty much all scenarios, although I have some tables and charts that I used to go over some very high-yield information for people. That's a step 2, step 3 class. And then I have a last-minute review on the 27th of this month. It's a 3-hour class. It's not supposed to be a deep, detailed review, but I'm going to be using a lot of integrative questions to go over a lot of very high-yield things for step 2, step 3. And then the first week in May, literally from May 1st to 5th, I have a 25-hour step 1 class. So if that's something you're interested in, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. Again, many people have taken these classes and they've done extremely well on their exams. All right. So let's get back to question 75. So again, if you're interested in any of these classes, they're all over Zoom. Just shoot me an email and I'll give you some more information. I can reserve your spot. So a 68-year-old woman returns to the office for a follow-up examination. So I guess let me comment on that 74 real quick again. Again, remember, when you suspect a patient safety event, you got to report it to a higher up. But the person has to be removed from patient care right there, right? The person that's impaired has to be removed. You got to report it to a higher up because option D looks good, but you're not reporting to any higher up. No, right? And that confrontation may not do anything, right? You may create like a very uncomfortable circumstance in the clinic that will just end up causing problems. You got to handle things cleanly. So I don't like option D. I like option E better. And then after you've done option E, then you do option F. All right, question 75. A 68-year-old woman returns to the office for a follow-up examination. 1 month ago, your analysis showed protein during workup of a suspected urinary tract infection. At that time, the patient was prescribed a 3-day course of oral cefalexin. Today, she says her previous pain on urination and urinary frequency have resolved. She has major depressive disorder and osteoarthritis. Current medications are venlafaxine and acetaminophen. Temperature is 37.0 degrees Celsius, that's 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 66 per minute, respirations are 18 per minute, and blood pressure is 122 over 66 millimeters of mercury. The patient appears physically fit. Examination discloses no abnormalities. Repeat urinalysis is shown. So the specific gravity is 1.015. Normally it's from 1.003 to 1.029. PG 6.0, that's normal. Protein is negative, blood is negative, leukocyte esterase is negative, nitrate is negative, white cells, 3 per high power field, that's not much. Red cells, 1 per high power field, that's not much. I don't really care about those. Okay, now which of the following is the most appropriate additional diagnostic study at this time? So option A says determination of the urine albumin to creatinine ratio. All right, option B says 24-hour urine collection for measurement of protein concentration. Option C says ultrasonography of the kidneys. Option D says urine sulfosalicylic acid method. Option E says no additional testing is indicated. So this person had a UTI, right? Okay. We treated the person for the UTI. All right. The person's UTI resolved. All right. And the person got better. And then now all of the person's vitals are completely fine. All of the person's labs are completely fine. Do you really want to do anything else for this person? Sounds like no is like the good answer for that question, right? Whenever a question is like completely like A-OK, this person needs like nothing, then do nothing, right? I don't see why we should really consider the other answers here. Option E makes a lot of sense. No additional testing is indicated, right? Option A, urine albumin to creatinine ratio. We measure that in diabetics to screen for microalbuminuria. Option B is something that relates more to like nephrotic syndrome, right? 24-hour urine collection of protein concentration, right? Because remember, nephrotic syndrome, for example, nephrotic or nephritic, I guess, nephritic less than 3.5 grams of protein in 24 hours, nephrotic more than 3.5 grams of protein in 24 hours, kidney ultrasound, this person doesn't have any structural kidney issue. Urine sulfur salicylic acid method, it's actually like a very quick, easy test that's kind of safe that can use to detect protein in a person's urine, right? So they like to use it in pregnant women every now and then. You just add sulfur salicylic acid to a person's urine. It's an acid. So, and if there's protein in the urine, it's going to denature the protein. After you denature the protein, the water is going to get turbid. The degree of turbidity will tell you, it's kind of a good surrogate for like the level of proteinuria in a sense. But again, how likely is it they're going to test that? Almost unlikely. And again, ask no what's, no, we're not going to do that here. I like option E for this one. This one's pretty easy. Okay. Question 76. A 22-year-old man is brought to the emergency department because of severe right lower leg pain since he fell in the woods during a camping trip 2 days ago. The pain has worsened during the past 12 hours. He sustained a small scratch below his knee as a result of the fall. He has no history of serious illness and uses no medications or other substances. He does not drink alcohol. Pulse is 110 per minute. Oh, that's not good. Respirations are 14 per minute. Blood pressure is 105 over 60. It's kind of trending low. Examination of the right lower extremity shows edema, diffuse cellulitis, and hemorrhagic bullae. Oh no, from the knee to the ankle. Oh no, that's not good. Okay, no abnormalities of the left lower extremity are noted. Peripheral intravenous antibiotic therapy and infusion of 2 liters of crystalloid fluid are begun. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Option A says FNA of the bullae. Option B says hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Option C says MRI of the right lower extremity. Option D says surgical debridement. Option E says hospital administration for observation only. All right, let's look at this, right? So this person was nicked just below their knee as we're going through the woods. And then we see from there, this person has severe pain. Look at those descriptors. The person has severe pain. The person is kind of hypotensive. You see diffuse cellulitis, hemorrhagic bullae. This is really bad. Right, so I'm kind of thinking that this person has necrotizing fasciitis. This person has neck fasc. So they've started antibiotics, they started fluids. Well, neck fasc, you gotta debride. You gotta debride. So I'm gonna go with option D here. Option E doesn't make any sense, just to observe. No, this person's process is rapidly spreading and getting worse. We're just gonna be observing. Option C says MRI. Again, that's something we'll be doing if we're worried about osteomyelitis, but that's not the pressing concern now. The pressing concern now is neck fasc. Option B says hyperbaric oxygen. No, if a person has neck fasc, you gotta debride. Option A says FNA of the bullet. FNA of a bullet? Come on, that's ridiculous. The answer is gonna be option D. Okay, question 77. A 27-year-old woman, gravidated 3-2, a 12-week gestation, comes to the office for her first prenatal visit. Her first child was delivered at 41 weeks gestation and weighed 4167 grams. That's 9 pounds, 3 ounces. It's a big baby. Her second child was delivered at 37 weeks gestation and weighed 4309 grams. That's 9 pounds, 8 ounces. That's a big baby as well. She has no history of serious illness and her only medication is a prenatal vitamin. Her sister has a history of delivering a stillborn infant. Her mother and father both have type 2 diabetes mellitus. 8 months ago, the patient immigrated to the United States from Mexico. The patient is 157 centimeters. That's 5'7", 2 inches tall. She weighed 95 kilograms. That's 210 pounds prior to her pregnancy. BMI was 38 kilograms per meter squared. She has had a 3 kilogram. That's a 6.6 pound weight gain during her pregnancy. Pulse is 80 per minute. Respirations are 14 per minute. And blood pressure is 110 over 60 millimeters of mercury. Bimanual examination shows a uterus consistent in size with a 12-week gestation. Ultrasonography confirms a 12-week gestation. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in management? Option A says antiphospholipid antibody screening. Option B says chest x-ray. Option C says fasting glucose tolerance test. Option D says measurement of serum alpha-fetoprotein concentration. Option E says measurement of serum free thyroxine concentration. This woman is delivering big babies. And I know some of you may be like, Divine, how do you know these babies are big? Can you give me the exact criteria? I can't. I literally don't know the exact criteria. But again, that's the thing. I feel like many people perseverate over certain details that just don't matter for the exam, right? Some of these things are just you applying some wisdom. Like, for example, I don't know the exact cutoffs, but I know that, man, 9-pound babies, like, that's just not usual, right? A baby that's 9 pounds, right? As a baby is approaching 10 pounds, it's probably a big baby. It's Probably a big baby, right? Probably a big baby. So these two babies are big, right? So that's fetal macrosomia. Well, what do we know about fetal macrosomia? It has a very strong association with diabetes. Very, very strong association with diabetes. So for me, I'm just like, man, what's the diabetes-related answer here? It's option C. I'm going to go with that. And I know some of you may be like, but Divine, we do the oral glucose tolerance test around 24 weeks. Yeah, we do. But the thing is, remember, if this person has a high risk of diabetes, which it sounds like she is, we probably want to figure out that she has diabetes now. When, you know, it's early in pregnancy, so we can start fixing it now so we can prevent that macrosomia down the line, stuff like that. So I'm going to go to option C. Option A only makes sense if we're told that, oh, this person has like recurrent pregnancy losses, venous thromboembolic disease, stuff like that. That's not what's going on here. I don't know what information we're trying to be gleaning from a chest x-ray. Measuring AFP and thyroxine levels doesn't make any sense to me here, so we're not going to do that. All right. Question 78. An 84-year-old woman comes to the office because of a one-month history of malaise. She has not had fever, weight loss, or abdominal pain. She has type 2 diabetes mellitus well controlled with long-acting insulin and metformin. She has missed multiple appointments during the past 6 months with no reasons given. Her hemoglobin A1C 6 months ago was 6.7%. She says she has been feeling fine. Her son moved back into her home 9 months ago because he had lost his job. The patient's husband died 5 years ago and she has no other children. She appears unkempt. She is alert and fully oriented. She is 163 centimeters, that's 5'4" tall, and weighs 77 kilograms, that's 170 pounds. BMI is 29 kilograms per meter squared. Her pulse is 80 per minute and regular. Respirations are 18 per minute, and the blood pressure is 160 over 94 millimeters of mercury. Mucous membranes are dry. There is no thrush. The skin is dry and intact. The remainder of the physical examination shows no abnormalities. Mental status examination shows no memory deficit. She has a normal mood and flat affect. Her fasting serum glucose concentration is 380 milligrams per deciliter. Results of your analysis are shown. Glucose 4+, that's a lot of glucose. Ketones none, nitrites none, leukesterase none. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? Option E says dietary indiscretion. Okay, that's an interesting answer. Option B says elder neglect. Option C says major depressive disorder. Option D says pancreatic malignancy. Come on, really? Option E says urinary tract infection. Right, for a month. Come on. Okay, so let's look at this, right? So what's abnormal here? Old person, malaise, right? She has type 2 diabetes that was well controlled, but now she's been missing appointments and she looks unkempt. Her blood pressure is pretty high, dry mucous membranes, dry skin. This person is not being properly cared for. And I know you may think, and you look at her glucose now, it's 380. And you may think that, oh, this could be depression, but she doesn't have sleep issues, doesn't have loss of interest, doesn't have guilt, doesn't have low energy, doesn't have concentration problems, doesn't have poor appetite, doesn't have psychomotor retardation, doesn't have suicidal ideation, doesn't have low mood. They don't have any of those things. Literally, this person essentially checks off nothing in the CGI caps plus no low mood criteria. That's ridiculous. So it's not MDD. This person is being abused. And again, we see a son kind of move back in. The son is not pulling his weight. This is elder neglect. It's actually a kind of elder abuse. And typically on the USMLEs, you're going to see an elder neglect question where this elderly person is no longer taking their medications. They're missing clinic appointments. They look unkempt. They just don't look like they're being well cared for. Physically, they look like malnourished. They look dehydrated. You're going to call adult protective services. That's what you need to do. So the answer is B. This is elder abuse. But again, as I've said in many of my review courses, I've said to many people that the USMLEs these days, they trade in derivatives. A person that has knowledge of the financial markets will be like, Divine, are you saying that the USMLEs are trading options and futures and all these exotic financial instruments? No. What do they do? Again, it's something I feel like came on online after they started, after Anki became very popular. Is they started using non-classic descriptors of things, right? If you put elder abuse, many people will be like, oh yeah, of course, that's going on here. But they was like, let's just change it around a little bit to elder neglect. So again, I'm telling you this, for you Anki users, there's nothing wrong with Anki. I know many people think that Divine is like an Anki hater. No, Anki is actually amazing. I believe Anki is really good because, I mean, I don't use it, but I've evaluated it and I feel like it's very beneficial for many people. But just make sure you're not just memorizing, make sure you understand what's going on. Make sure that, oh, this thing that I learned, what's the context behind it? What are other ways it could be described? All right. So, you know, option C doesn't make any sense here. This person doesn't have pancreatic cancer. No jaundice, no LFT, bilirubin labs, whatever. No. No weight loss. UTI, come on. Dietary indiscretion. That's why her glucose is skyrocketing. No, her son is not taking care of her. That's why her glucose is skyrocketing. Looks like the woman was doing pretty well before her son came. Maybe that son does kind of need to leave the home. Okay, anyway. All right. Question 79. A 15-year-old boy is brought to the office 2 hours after he awoke with weakness of the right side of his face. He has a two-week history of intermittent headache, sensitivity to light, and mild to moderate neck pain. He has no history of serious illness. His only medication is acetaminophen as needed. He lives in New Jersey and has not traveled outside of the state during the past 6 months. Temperature is 37.4 degrees Celsius, that's 99.3 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 78 per minute and regular. Blood pressure is 108 over 70 millimeters of mercury. Flexion of the neck elicits moderate pain and resistance. So like no rigidity. Again, they could have just written no rigidity, but you see, they described it. The right eyelids do not close completely. Ocular movements are normal. There's no evidence of ptosis. The right side of the forehead does not wrinkle when the patient looks up. There is severe weakness of the right corner of his mouth, of the mouth. There are no abnormalities on the left of the left side of the face. Muscle strength in the jaw, tongue and palate is normal and symmetric. There's no dysarthria. Muscle strength is 5 out of 5 in all extremities. Coordination and sensation are intact. Gait is normal. A lumbar puncture is performed and opening pressure is 180 millimeters of water. CSF analysis results are shown. So glucose is 60 milligrams per deciliter. Total protein is 52 milligrams per deciliter. White cell count is 85 per millimeter cubed. Segmented neutrophils is 30%. Lymphocytes is 70%. Red cells is 1 per millimeter cubed. Which of the following is the most appropriate next step in diagnosis? So option A says measurement of serum angiotensin converting enzyme activity. Option B says measurement of serum line, that's Borrelia burgdorferi, antibody concentration. Option C says polymerase chain reaction test for cytomegalovirus. Option D says serum anti-nuclear antibody assay. Option E says serum protein electrophoresis. Okay, so this person seems to have meningitis, actually. They have no rigidity. And then we can see like one side of the face is super weak. That's Bell's palsy. Well, what's the answer? What's the thing we know that, ooh, Bell's palsy. Bell's palsy is usually going to be associated with herpes on the exams or with Lyme disease, right? And remember, Lyme disease can cause like almost like an aseptic meningitis. I like that answer a lot for Lyme disease, right? Borrelia burgdorferi, it's a spirochete. So I think I'm going to go with option B here. This person, I think, has Lyme disease. This is not CMV. CMV is usually going to be in the immunocompromised on a newborn that has like microcephaly, periventricular calcifications. That's not what's going on here. And CMV can also be in people that have had transplants as well. ANA, that's lupus. We're not going to do that. SPEP, that's multiple myeloma. This person is too young for multiple myeloma. Serum ACE activity, that's going to be in sarcoidosis. Nah, I'm going to go with option B here. And remember, this person is probably going to be getting IV ceftriaxone. Whenever you have Lyme disease that's torching your brain or your heart, you're going to reach out for Rocephin. You're going to reach out for ceftriaxone. All right, let's do one more question and then we'll call it. So, question 80. A two-year-old girl is brought to the emergency department because of loud breathing, harsh cough, and a hoarse cry since she awoke 1 hour ago. Oh, her parents state that yesterday she had a runny nose. All right. Medical history is unremarkable and receives no medication. Temperature is 38.5 degrees Celsius. That's 101.3 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 120 per minute. Respirations are 32 per minute. And blood pressure is 105 over 65 millimeters of mercury. There are moderate suprasternal and subcostal retractions. Inspiratory stridor is heard at rest. Which of the following is the most appropriate initial pharmacotherapy? Option A says intravenous dexamethasone. Option B says nebulized albuterol. Option C says nebulized budesonide. Option D says nebulized epinephrine. Option E says oral albuterol. Option F says oral prednisone. Option G says subcutaneous epinephrine. So what does the child have? Let's see, right? So it's a young kid. Loud breathing, harsh cough, hoarse cry. MBA means, how could you have made our life simpler? You could have said things like, this person has a barking, seal-like cough, a brassy cough, has stridor. Remember, when you see stridor, tells you it's upper airway. They tell us the stridor. But instead of saying a barking or a brassy-like cough, they say, oh, loud breathing, harsh cough, and a hoarse cry. That's literally them telling us this person has a barky, brassy cough. Again, buzzwords are extinct, or they have rapidly become extinct from the USMLEs. Right? And this person has stridor. This is an upper airway thing. So what is this? This is going to be croup. This person has croup. Remember, croup, they can call it laryngotracheobronchitis on your exams. Okay? Laryngotracheobronchitis. Typically, you don't have to do any formal workup, but if you got like a chest x-ray or whatever, you'll see that steeple sign. Kind of looks like a wine bottle in the upper airway. Again, whenever you see an upper airway problem, you're going to see stridor. Lower airway problem, you're going to see wheezing. This is an upper airway problem. And does this person, and honestly, the management of croup typically is supportive care. But if they have severe symptoms, let's say they have like really nasty fever, really struggling to breathe, then there's pretty much two things you need to do for them. You need to put epinephrine through their airway. So you got to give them like epinephrine through the airway to open up that airway. Because that closed up glottis is not good, right? So you kind of want to open that airway. Although it's more of a subglottic problem. It's a subglottic problem. So you want to pay attention to that word, subglottic. You want to open up the airway. Give something that's like a beta 2 agonist. That's very powerful and rapid acting. And then typically they're going to get steroids. You can give IV steroids, but most people do well with oral steroids. Most people do well with oral steroids. But again, this person does not really seem to be in a situation to be getting oral steroids because it looks like this person's airway is closing. So you need to do something and do something quick. Okay. And steroids take a while to kick in and start working. Right. So again, we need to give that albuterol. This person has pretty severe symptoms. If we don't do anything, this child is going to die, basically, is what's going to happen. So we need to open up that airway quick, right? Open up that airway quick. And please, I know you may be like, Divine, can we use a beta 2 agonist like we do for asthma or COPD exacerbations? No, those are not very great in people that have croup. So don't do that. That's not going to be very, very helpful. Okay, so let's work through these answers. I think this is actually a pretty useful exercise to know which answer is right, why the right answer is right, and all the other answers are wrong. Option A says IV dexamethasone. Again, that's something we're going to do for this person because this person's airway is closing. We're going to do that, but it's not the right first step. We need to open up this person's airway immediately so that they don't die. This person has a high fever. They're super tachycardic. They're super tachypneic, right? We see all these subcostal suprasternal retractions. We hear stridor. We need to act immediately. IV steroids is going to take a while to kick in. So that's wrong. Option B says nebulized albuterol. Beta 2 agonists pretty much have no role in the management of croup. Option C says nebulized budesonide. Again, that's inhaled steroids. Again, it doesn't really have much of any role in the... you could use it in some circumstances, but again, this person's symptoms are pretty severe, right? And most times in croup, oral steroids are preferred as first line in terms of steroid over IV steroid. IV steroid is something you use when a person is super unstable. They can't swallow anything or whatever, right? This person is super unstable. So even oral steroids, we're probably not going to do that. We're going to try IV steroids, right? So nebulized steroids, it's not really going to do much. Option D says nebulized epinephrine. I like that answer a lot. I'm going to go with option D here. But let's look at the others. Option E says oral albuterol. Again, before it kicks in, the person may be dead. You don't want that. Option F says oral prednisone. Again, this person's airway is barely open. They have stridor. We're not going to do that. Option G says subcutaneous epinephrine. Nah, IV epinephrine. IV epinephrine is like a kind of cardiac epinephrine. That's like ACLS protocol right there. This is not ACLS, right? IV epinephrine, you better believe that that's kind of a lot of epinephrine. Although I guess they don't say intravenous, they say subcutaneous. So give it under the skin. Not really. Right. So this person, you need to put epinephrine down her airway. That's one. And then number two, you should give this person IV steroids. If the person was not so, did not have such a tenuous course, did not have such severe symptoms, you wouldn't have to do that. Usually we prefer oral steroids. So if a person has like, again, so let me maybe address the management of croup. Typically supportive care. But if the person is unstable, the person has severe disease, then that person is going to be getting oral steroids, right? But if they're like super unstable like this person, you're going to give IV steroids, right? IV steroids, and you're going to bubble epinephrine down their airway. That's how you manage croup, okay? That's how you manage croup. And again, remember, another name for croup is laryngotracheobronchitis. So let's go ahead and stop here. Again, I offer all these review courses for the exams. If you're interested, shoot me an email, give some more information. And also made a separate podcast talking about that. And then I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel where I post the videos I make. I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE, all the complex exams, med school exams, shelf exams. And I help with applications, ERAS applications, all those things. Something I've done with tons of people over the years. And I've had a very, very great track record with that. Then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Pretty much every week on Fridays, Sundays, I post a 10-minute podcast. Typically, I use a biblical perspective. Many of you know I'm a Christian. It's a biblical perspective to address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. Again, many people have listened to it, to those podcasts. We have about 260 or thereabouts. Many people have found it to be extremely helpful. So check that out. Check that out. Again, the website there is DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. So thank you for listening to me today. I'll see you in episode 530. God bless you. Have an awesome weekend and bye for now. Thank you.